New Testament reading is taken from Mark chapter 12 and verses 38 to 44. As he taught, he said, "Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive greater condemnation." He sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Then he called his disciples and said to them, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of those who are contributing to the treasury, for all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on."
It may well fall within the months when a notable church celebrates its 150th anniversary, but Remembrance Day is always difficult. It's as if we hear the clash, the good and the best that we can do collide together. We remember the war. And there are stories of heroism and great sacrifice, deeds of love. But we remember it also was war, this testimony to the inability of Homo sapiens to settle disputes and look to the future without seeking to kill one another. The best and the worst. Remembrance Day. It's the heady story of our humanity that we share, a story full of grief and glory. I think we sensed something of that tension in the silence, did we not? What was going through your mind? There was a mixture of pride and thankfulness, we won. And thankfulness for what was given for us, because we have a freedom we would not otherwise know. And surely somewhere there was, "Oh Lord, don't let it happen again. Give peace in our time, oh Lord." This mixture of feelings. This is always a difficult day. This church was already into its life in 1868, properly, formally engaged as a church the year later, and it flourished in those early years. Many leading citizens of this city were part of its life as the church made its mark. Or so the historians tell us. But within less than 50 years, Britain was engaged in what people called the Great War. Only it turned out to be only the first of two world wars. And goodness knows how you decide which is the greater. Tyndale lived the war years, of course. It received bad news, bearing grief. You imagine the Sunday pastoral news as the congregation gathered. More than 70 members were active in the battle, at least 19 killed in active service from the church and its various connections. And at home, the members were quick to respond to the refugees that came, mainly from Belgium. The record shows deep compassion of the members for those who lived through the difficult days, giving care, making friendships, taking ecumenical strides forward that later would be said were very rash. And in it all, somehow, maintaining the regular worship of God. Tyndale lived the war years, and with the rest of the country, knew the pain. What, frankly, I find utterly surprising is that at that time, the minister of the church, Herbert Morgan, was a declared pacifist. I have taught Christian ethics in two universities. I have discovered that the most virulent arguments I ever have are around pacifism. I wonder what it would have been like. Can you imagine it? The historians tell us that Morgan was careful not to parade his views and that he was very quick to offer pastoral support and care to those who thought differently and whose sons and fathers had gone to the battle. He did not wash his hands. He did not walk away. He was the minister of Tyndale. Morgan energetically led the church in those years of fearfulness and changing social problems. He believed the church had a pivotal role to play before God in shaping society. He personally believed that war was wrong. All war was unchristian and sinful. But during those years, he led the church into ways of care and compassion, facing the reality of our human sin, never forgetting the Lord's goodness, and not least the teaching about love for enemies. Reading the new history, I was struck by the way Tyndale and its minister faced all of this confusion together, showing how it was and how it is possible to have divided opinions held within one strong common loyalty. The loyalty of members and minister was to Jesus Christ. They looked to him, the revelation of the Creator, Savior, God. The divided opinions were about the practice of discipleship, of how you worked out God's purposes in the world. And of course, many of the arguments they would have engaged in, we have still going on amongst ourselves now. That will always be the case in a church serious about its calling. Tyndale lived with that tension. It shaped its life. It seems to me it set something of a trajectory for the future. Here was a church of many voices, but blending and belonging together, not just by human endeavor or appeals to good manners, so much as a sense that we were here because God had brought us together. In all our diversity, God was seeking through us and in us to work his salvation. The church lived before God. It had different opinions, but one great common loyalty. like all churches. Tyndale was then caught up into the social and religious changes that resulted from the First World War. The loss of young life, the changing attitudes to the church and society, rising obvious economic injustice and unemployment, plainly visible in different parts of Bristol. Tyndale sought ways to respond to these sad, broken features of local life, but hugely impressive in particular were the international notes the church kept on striking. Such was the wide vision of life in God and life before God. So the church gave support to the League of Nations, some of its members being sent to peace conferences in Europe, reporting back to the church meeting. And later, when the time came, the church gave more than economic support to the United Nations. For God so loved the world. Discipleship had to be international, ecumenical, welcoming, seeking peace and justice for all, or it was something less than Christian discipleship. The church knew that and gave good evidence of its conviction, divided opinions perhaps within a common loyalty, a seeking to do God's will on earth as it is in heaven. 1939 brought war again. Tyndale's immediate response was to raise funds and send them to Baptists in Czechoslovakia. That was but one further illustration of Tyndale's considerable international and denominational awareness, giving support while being unashamedly ecumenically open. Divided opinions within a common loyalty again. Because if you love only those who love you, you remember what Jesus said? December 1940, and the bombs fell truly on Tyndale. What we build with care and labor, tower and temple fall to dust. The ruined building erected to the praise and glory of God became a ruin. But August 1941 saw, amid the ruins, candidates coming for baptism, declaring in the rubble of war's destruction who they believed in the end was the Lord and where salvation and hope was to be found. The photographs of that moment are striking, inspiring, a statement of the faith of the church in the living incarnate God in the midst of the world's confusion and despair. It is one of the great gifts to the wider church, that photograph, those baptisms in August 41. But again in war, the church did what it could in practical matters. Garments were made and sent out to the troops. There was care given for those whose homes had been lost in the bombing. Care for the wounded, care for those being demobilized, care for all, regardless of where they came from and what was their history. And all this was understood to be part of the church's calling, witnessing to the triune God. Its building, but not its life, lay in ruins. So Tyndale continued its ministry towards refugees, the vulnerable, the aged, those with all manner of needs, while at the same time being intent on building up the spiritual life of the fellowship, life before God, life in God. You see, at its best, and I think Tyndale has often been at its best. Tyndale has known that a local church is fundamentally called into the great mission of God for the sake of the world. Its own life and growth has rarely been an end in itself for us. And time would not allow me to tell of the huge denominational commitment this church has made, looking way beyond its own life, to its contribution to the university, to truth in its beauty, or to the college and issues of ministerial and missionary formation. Its contribution to missionary engagement involved not just enormous generosity in money, but the lives of those given in service and sacrifice. If I missed anything in the book, it was, and what about those who went from this fellowship into the ordained ministry of our churches in this country? I know some of them, and they were fine people. And then there's come what we've come to call church planting. At Westbury and Lawrence Weston, and help given elsewhere in the association again and again and again, we share today the life story of a very remarkable Christian church, nothing less than a part of the story of God. Tyndale has never been known for being closed, tight-minded, although people have held and doubtless still hold very strong convictions here. Members have thought and argued together about the faith, about its lived implications, of what it is to worship God. So again I recite my refrain, different opinions within a common loyalty, so becoming an example of something crucial for the whole church and not least for the world. There are no finished articles this side of God's new creation. It's all still in the making. And words like absolute and perfect and complete, these are words the older theologians always kept for God. They're not for us. Tyndale, I think, has always known its humanity. There has been a dark side to nation and church, and we have not ignored it. But it has put its faith in God, the God known in Jesus, the foundation hope of the church through these changing, sometimes very frightening and uncertain times, is God. Revealed in Jesus, unspeakably in cross and sacrifice and resurrection. The shared commitment was to God, because we had heard and sensed, not least in the life of the church, of God's primary commitment to us. This astonishing story that the church goes on telling. The Christian witness to things eternal, of course we do, but there's always a provisionality about our life. Churches can sometimes forget this. They make idols of their buildings or their theologies. They deify their own opinions, offering worship which is sometimes little more than self-congratulation. You remember this morning's gospel reading? It came from the Common Revised Lectionary, so that we should hear what the whole church is hearing today. We heard Jesus' outright condemnation of ostentatious, hypocritical religion, a way that exploited others, especially the vulnerable. The religion of Vanity Fair, all show and no substance. And then came this widow, biblical symbol of the exploited, the victims, the nobodies. And she throws all she has into the temple treasury. What did you think of that? Did it impress you? You may not be impressed. After all, she's now made herself destitute, dependent on others. A wonderful gift, no doubt, but thoroughly reckless. And what's more, she's given her offering to a corrupt organization, which, according to Jesus, a couple of more verses later into Mark's gospel, hasn't got long to exist anyway. So we might see her actions through the lenses of our suspicious 21st century. But Jesus seems to see her favorably, certainly in contrast to those religiously successful folk. And so she appears in Mark's gospel, the heroine of the very last scene of Jesus' public ministry. Because the next thing that happens in Mark is Jesus talking about the temple and the end, and then the long, long passions narrative of somebody else giving their all to God. But she appears, this woman, this heroine. How are Christian disciples to live in these days? The history of Tyndale is marked by generosity and sacrifice and service. In this company, people have been found by Jesus Christ and have tried to follow him. Honestly, there's always been ambiguity. There's always been something of that uncertainty that Remembrance Day exposes. But our story, therefore, includes both human failure and pride, and thankfully, God's love and everlasting mercy towards us sinners, prompting acts of wonder, sacrifice, and love. We are glad to be part of the church. We realize we are at our best when we live with others before God, holding divided opinions, maybe, but within that common loyalty, trusting in the end to the goodness and love of God known in Jesus. For disciples in every generation, there is no escaping this tension that turns out to be cross-shaped. Reinhold Niebuhr, an American theologian of the last century, who I guess was pretty often quoted in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s from the pulpit here in Tyndale. Reinhold Niebuhr put this kind of stark realism sharply, this tension that is there in the true church, in true discipleship. He said, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. And nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. And nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we must be saved by love. And no virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness." T. Tyndale has lived this kind of faith in times of war and peace. In Jesus Christ, it has realized a calling, a hope and salvation greater than its own life. So it has thrown itself into God's love for the world, doing what it can and leaving the rest to God, trusting that in the Lord, our labor is never going to be lost. That's what God goes on calling us to. God, who for all our emphasis upon ourselves, still remains the chief actor in the great cosmic drama and the great promise of the world's salvation. St. Paul put it like this: since it is by God's mercy that we are engaged in this ministry, we do not lose heart. We have renounced the shameful things that one hides. We refuse to practice cunning or to falsify God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we commend ourselves to the conscience of everyone in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of the invisible God. For we do not proclaim ourselves. We proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For it is the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," who has shone into our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. To whom be all praise and glory forever and forever.